Father God, we thank you and praise you for giving us your word. Father, we ask for you to teach us what it is you want us to know. Help us to understand more about you as we go through this. And Father, we just pray for your wisdom. We thank you for all these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen. Okay, well, we are taking another look at Matthew 28, 1. And the reason why we are going through this in such a long stage is just as we talked about last week, for those of you who are here or for those of a couple weeks, thank you, is there's a whole lot of history that's involved in this. And if we want to look at this, it's good that we take a look at this from the perspective of the history involved in this, and also a lot of the aspects that we should look at as we look at any verse, and that's looking at the history that's behind these events, looking at the train of thought of whoever is speaking, so that we understand the context of it, that we try to understand any biases. Now, biases, as we talked about, is not a bad thing. It just means a point of view. We need to understand the point of view of whoever it is that we're talking, whether it be a particular writer of a gospel, the perspective they're coming from, or whether we're looking in a particular translation, what perspective the translator is coming from, the lexicon writers, commentators, whoever. We have to understand what kind of perspective they're coming from, and that can color things. Also, to kind of look at the facts that are involved to make sure that they agree with one another, and that we understand the language and that we're all speaking the same language, even if we're speaking different languages such as Greek and Hebrew and such like that, that are in the Bible. So that the terms that we are using are similar terms and such. So that gets us into the passage here. So we'll just read through this again, just so we can get a grounding of where we're going to go from. And that's Matthew 28, 1. Now after the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to look at the grave. And that's from the New American Standard Version. Anybody have a different version, like a King James Version, New International Version?
NIV.
NIV? What's the NIV render that is?
NIV.
Yeah, what's the, how does that read in the NIV? Ah, yes. After the Sabbath, at the dawn of the first day of the week. And that's how that renders it. Anyone else have a different form of it? Okay.
After Shabbat, toward dawn on Sunday.
Okay.
King James says, in the end of the Sabbath, that it began to dawn toward the first day of the week.
Okay. Yes.
I have the way I learned it version.
All right.
Now, after the Erev was over, as the first of the weeks began to dawn.
Okay. So it's a good way to look at it. So I guess the question then comes down, did Yeshua arise on the first day of the week, the first of the Sabbaths, or the first of the weeks? These are all different. First of the weeks, these are all ways that we can look at this. And the challenge, I mean, this is a pretty complicated question, because when we're looking at this, the Greek passages here, you know, regarding Yeshua's resurrection, by all the gospel writers, use a Hebrew word, actually, that's pulled over into Greek, and sabbaton, which comes from shabbaton. And, of course, is the transliteration thereof. So, and the challenge is that shabbaton can refer to one or more Sabbaths. It can mean one Sabbath. It can also mean Sabbaths in plural. And the other challenge is that sabbaton is grammatically plural in Greek, because there is the a singular form of that, which is sabbato, which is used in a couple of places, one of which is in Mark 16:9, and another case in Luke 18:12 about, you know, I fast twice in a week. That's shabbato, or sabbato, which in Greek would be. That's the singular form and such. So we got that challenge there because Greek does have a word for week. And it's actually used in the Septuagint, and we'll get to that in a bit here. But in these passages throughout the Gospels, it used mostly sabbaton when we're talking about the Sabbath. You know, in all those passages when you're reading pretty much throughout the Gospels, and it's talking about you did this on the Sabbath, you did that on the Sabbath this happened, it's pretty much sabbaton is what's used, or obviously the grammatical equivalent to it. Now, what makes this kind of perplexing about the timing of these things is that, especially in Matthew 28:1, is the word sabbaton is used twice in the same passage. You know, so you get that idea of, you know, after the Sabbath, at the dawning of the, you know, because literally, I mean, here's basically it's like a Green's literal translation is what this would be. But after the Sabbath, at the dawning of the first of Sabbaths, is what that is, as how you could see that in a literal, just pulling over from Greek. But the translation could be first day of the week because of a common way of rendering the days of the week that's found in the Talmud. In the Talmud, in quite a few places actually, it conveys the idea of the days of the week, especially in the first century time, of being first of the Sabbath. You'll see it oftentimes in here. Here's quite a few different passages in here. For example, let's see. This comes from Lightfoot, which was, you know, he took a look at the Gospels and the Talmud and compared them back in the 1600s. And one of the things he came across is quite a few references to this, you know, talking about a virgin is to be married on the fourth day of the Sabbath. That's literally what it says in the Hebrew in the Talmud. And talking about the red heifer is to be set apart to be burned on the fourth of the Sabbath, the fourth day of the Sabbath. Ezra, the interpretation is that Ezra interpreted that the law should be read publicly on the second and fifth days of the Sabbath. This is a very common thing throughout rabbinical literature of the first century, that this construction, this day of the Sabbath, that day of the Sabbath, and numbers of the days of the week. Yeah, you have a question?
Well, wouldn't that be, you know, like in a Hebrew calendar, and not necessarily on American Hebrew calendars, but Israeli Hebrew calendars say day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They don't call them names.
Right.
So wouldn't that be another way of saying the fifth day of the Sabbath, meaning that rather than the fifth day of what? I mean, could that be a delineation?
Well, that was what was referred to as the days of the week. You know, the shortened
right.
form is today. This is the first day, second day, third day.
Right.
But in rabbinical literature, it's often written the first day of the Sabbath, the second day of the
right.
Sabbath, and that's like first day, second day of the week, those kinds of things. Those ground it in time. So that's why you get that idea that, you know, because here in Matthew, you've got at the end of the Sabbath, and that is also in rabbinical literature. They would say, like, well, the Sabbath was ending, meaning we would say kind of like the Havdalah time, or the time when you're separating the Sabbath from the beginning of the next week. And so you've got two time references that put this in time in Matthew 28:1. You've got at the end of the Sabbath, or is the that point is, and then you've got toward the dawning of the first of the Sabbath. So that is a possibility. We have to acknowledge that that is very present in rabbinic literature.
Did they use the word sabbaton in that?
Shabbat. In rabbinical literature, it is the first of the Shabbat.
I don't mean in this text. I mean in usage, in common usage, did they say the first day of the Sabbaton or Shabbaton at any point?
Well, because the Talmud is in Hebrew, and the Greek here is obviously pulling over. That was a common usage for Greek, at least here in the Gospels, was to use Sabbaton for Shabbat. See, in Hebrew, there's a more specific form of it. There's Shabbat, Shabbaton, you know, Shabbat, Shabbaton, you know, very specific things of those. But in Greek, it came across as Shabbaton. You know, there's not like one or the other or something else like that. So you have to at least acknowledge, and we look at that as that is a possibility. Now, I guess the question could come in and is often raised about, you know, Acts chapter 20. You know, you might talk about Acts chapter 20, where Paul is having his midnight preach all night, you know, extravaganza there, and guy falls out the window and dies, and he heals him. Okay. Well, one of the things that's referred to there is, you know, so is does that mean, if we were to take it that to mean, oh, that was the first day of the week, because it's the same construction, pretty much the same construction that we have there in Matthew 28. So does that mean then that we're talking about that they're having a church service on the first day of the week? So the question, though, is that when you look at this passage, when it says, you know, on the first day of the week, if we were to take that rendering, in the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them, intending to leave the next day. And he prolonged his message until midnight. There were many lamps in the upper room when we were gathered together. And then you skip down and it said that Paul was talking until daybreak and then left. So one of the things that you look at there is this is obviously talking about, this is the end of the Sabbath, because the first day of the week, this was dark time, and he was going in to leave the next day also on the first day of the week. So that's why some modern translations actually render this on Saturday night, because that's literally what time you're talking about here. So just to keep that in mind, that this is a possible reading for this idea of first day of the weeks. Now, to your question here about first of the weeks, now that is another way, because that is literally what you could read here, that this was the first day, the dawning of the first of the weeks there in Matthew 28:1.
In Acts 20, verse 7, is that also Shabbaton?
Yeah, yeah. Anyway,
exactly the same.
Yeah, it's pretty much where you see that.
Just as much the first of the Sabbath of the counting as it could be. The first day of the week.
However, but when you look at that, it could be in the same situation, and we'll get to that just here in a moment. Okay. Now, suppose then that this means the first of the weeks in relation to this. This could possibly be that you have a conjunction of the first day of the week and the first of the weeks of the 7 weeks leading up to Shavuot. That is a possibility. If you were to take this as this was the first day, was the day of the wave sheaf, and thus you would be starting on the count of the 7 weeks going up to what we call Pentecost or Shavuot. That is a possibility where you've got the conjunction in the same thing. Now, possibility also could be that that is what is talked about in Acts 20. Don't know. However, there is one thing that is often brought out there and refers down into 1 Corinthians chapter 16, referring to the first of the weeks. Again, this is talking about taking up the collection. Yeah, Bill.
And Rich talked about this one time, about the word moral.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
It says moral here in Acts. I mean, yeah, Acts chapter 20 here, something different. Is that word? How's that play?
Yeah, we'll get to that eventually, but that is a question we will approach here. Now, when you look at this passage here in 1 Corinthians 16, the idea here is that in verse 2, on the first day of each week, each one is to put aside and save as he may prosper so that no collections are to be made. When I arrive, whomever you may approve, I will send with letters and carry your gift to Jerusalem. And if it be fitting for me also to go, then they will go with me. So here is another passage. Now, the interesting part of this is that the construction is not necessarily the same, in that you do have weeks here, the Shabbaton as before, but the first thing is a little bit different. It's not the same first that you do have in the other ones. Now, the possibility is, and some people have made this before, is that when you look in 1 Corinthians, especially when you get down into the later part of it, like we were looking at 2 weeks ago with 1 Corinthians chapter 15, is that this has a lot of these contexts here, talking about puffing up and talking about that sort of thing. Now, one of the things that is a possibility is that this is a time frame of where he's talking about. He's saying about taking up a collection on the first of the weeks, because he also says down in verse 8, but I will remain in Ephesus until Pentecost. So this is saying Pentecost is coming. So there again is the potential that this could be talking about, because think about it. What is the bringing in of the first fruits? This is saying that the first harvest of the year has begun. Start bringing it in. Start bringing it in. So if you're living in a, like Daniel's mentioned many times regarding tithe, if you're living in a monetary society versus an agricultural society, you can get kind of the sense of the bringing in the harvest as well during the same time period. And some people also took up collections, especially ran around Pentecost. They would actually have in church history, you get that idea of taking up collections on Pentecost.
I'm just thinking the earlier setting of this letter in chapter 5 and chapter 11, Paul is talking about let us keep the feast. And then in chapter 11, at the end of chapter 11, he's talking about how to have a Seder.
Yeah, there you go.
So it would seem that that would be the perfect, that could definitely link to that.
Yeah, because you get this kind of flow here. And, you know, you have to remember that this was a letter written to a specific congregation for specific purposes. And you get kind of a flow of thought throughout Paul's letter. So that's just something to keep in mind as we go along here. Yes.
On Acts 21 and on in the Corinthians, when both of them are right before day of Pentecost.
Yeah. So there you go. There is a possible rendering as well. So you have to kind of take into consideration that on one hand, rabbinical literature does have that construction, first day of the Shabbat, meaning first day of the week. So that is a possibility. But then we also could have the conjunction of the first of the weeks and the first day of the week in the same thing. Now, that is just kind of good to get that off the table. And the other thing to note about this thing in 1 Corinthians 16 is that the Greek could also be rendered, since it doesn't say first, it says one. So basically on a Shabbat, or on a first day of the week, actually, is what it would be. That could be one as well. Because since it is Shabbaton, it could be rendering on the first day of the week, or it could be on a Shabbat. It's one of those things you don't know, but if you look at the context, like we mentioned, of unleavened bread Passover and Pentecost that Paul's talking about in the same letter, it could be one and the same. Now, again, we have to get back to this question of, well, why do we care about all this? And as we looked at it the last time, that as we were going through Matthew 27, talking about the crucifixion and stuff like that, that things related to time are very important, and things related to fulfillment of prophecy related to what Yeshua was going to do and who he was were extremely important. And they remembered these details of fulfillment and this and that and the other based on what had come before. So one of the next questions that we should at least take a look at, and this will again get a little bit clearer a little bit later, is the question, was Yeshua in the grave for 3 days and three nights, or was he in the grave, did he rise in 3 days, or after 3 days, or on the third day, and such like that? I mean, that's a question that we should ask. If we're asking questions about what is God trying to show us with why these things come down into certain time frames, what is the overall picture of where God is going with this, we have to at least go through and ask that question. Now, one of the things that we get at on the question, well, was it 3 days and three nights? Was it on the third day? Is there a difference? Are they one and the same? Are they different? We should at least get into that question. Now, 3 days and three nights we'll get to is Matthew 12:42. That's where we get that passage from. Matthew 12:42.
Can't they be the
same? Well, we'll look at that. We'll look at that question. We'll look at that question if they're one and the same. Now, the passage there going from, actually it starts in 38, kind of as that passage begins. Matthew 12, starting in 38, and talking about this, asking for a sign. Some of the Pharisees asked him, "Teacher, we want you to give you a sign." But he answered and said to them, "An evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, and yet no sign will be given it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will stand up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, someone greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south will rise up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it, because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, something greater than Solomon is here." Now there's this passage of the 3 days and three nights in relation to this sign of Jonah. Okay, the challenge though is that is it. Regarding 3 days and three nights, that is it. There are no other passages throughout any of the New Testament that refer to 3 days and three nights. However, there are at least 16 or 17 references to third day, on the third day, after 3 days, 3 days later, until 3 days, on the third day. So there's those references there. Most of those are kind of parabolic, meaning that they were a part of this parable Yeshua would say. You'd say, you know, tear down this temple, and in 3 days I'm going to build it up again. And you know, they brought it up in his trial and all this stuff. You know, and everybody's thinking about the building and thinking, well, that's a preposterous thing to say about tearing down the temple and such like that. So that when we look at this, we should at least be somewhat careful that when we're looking at this, that one way or the other way we go with it, that we're not basing things on a single passage and making everything else tailor to one passage. For example, if it says something in one place, yet it says something else in many, many other different places, that we don't make all of the other things fit into the meaning of one place. That is just a possibility that we need to consider. That we need to consider in that regard. Now, the other question, though, comes down to does 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth refer to Yeshua's time in the grave? Now, that's a good question to at least ask. And we can think of it historically because there are things that they found in the catacombs of Rome and such like that of the idea of Jonah being in the whale and coming out of the whale was thought of as a picture of resurrection. So early believers at least had that in their mind, that that was a picture of resurrection related to the story of Jonah and being in the whale or the fish or whatever that big monster was. Now, the question, though, if the heart of the earth refers to the grave, the question, though, comes in is, would that be literally 3 days and three nights? Because we have to compare that with some other things that are also messianic prophecies and certain things that Yeshua did refer to him himself, related to Psalm 16:10. That's something that we looked at back in the last chapter in Matthew 27. Psalm 16:10. For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, or the grave, nor will you allow your Holy One to undergo decay. The second one, and this has been a messianic verse for a long, long time, going back quite a long time into the history of believers, and that's from Hosea 6, verse 2. Hosea 6, verse 2 has a passage, and it's interesting that when you look at this passage from Hosea, this is in, of course, obviously the context of renewal, because you have to remember the historical context of Hosea. Hosea was coming at a time when you remember the whole story of Hosea. You know, he had the wife that kept running off on him and stuff like that, and he was commanded to keep taking her back. You know, it was quite a great picture of God when you see the prophecy of Hosea, a God that will keep taking his adulterous wife back to him, just like God keeps taking back his people who keep running off this way and running off that way and whatever. And one of the things that you get from Hosea is this passage here in 6:2. He will revive us after 2 days. He will raise us up on the third day that we may live before him. The other challenge that we have with this passage is that heart of the earth is not something that ever shows up anywhere else in the Bible at all. And it also is a problem because it doesn't show up in Greek literature and it doesn't show up anywhere in anything else. So question is, heart of the earth, what is that? What is that? Could be. I mean, at least we have to at least entertain that idea. Now, early believers obviously associated Jonah and the sign of Jonah with the grave and resurrection. I mean, that was obvious. You see it actually on the baptismal, you know, when they made these little mikvahs down there in the catacombs, they would have this little picture of Jonah and the whale.
Well, we not associate that also.
Yes, so that's obviously a valid idea. Right. So the question, though, is that could it come in there? Could it not? So let's at least entertain the idea that it could be one way or it could be the other way. The other way being that 3 days and three nights was also the amount of time that Lazarus spent in the grave, and he was stinking, in other words, rotting. So that's something to also take into account.
Yeah, well, in Jewish thought, it took 3 days for the soul to completely leave the body.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the three-day issue, and on the fourth day was Yeshua wanted them to know Lazarus was completely dead and that his soul had finally left.
Well, Lazarus also didn't have a spear stuck into him and have blood and water come out of him. That that was quite a bit of a different thing that a lot of people witnessed. So that was quite a bit of a different thing, yes.
Also, if I remember right, did not the men anoint him with oil before they put him into the grave, Messiah?
Well, yeah, they put a whole bunch of stuff on him.
Okay, and that makes, they use cedar wood, that makes a lot of difference in how fast you decompose.
I suppose so.
That's what it is.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Weren't they going on the morning?
Yeah.
The men were going, but
they were going with a whole lot of stuff.
He was anointed.
He was obviously, when he came out, he was wearing burial clothes.
Yeah.
So he was wearing those to begin with. Now, one of the things to think about is that when we're thinking about this whole week here, is that all of these things that lead up to the time of where Messiah was are all a unit. Because when you think of the idea of the Lamb Selection Day, and then Passover, and then, of course, the Days of Unleavened Bread start, and then, there you've got the first fruits in there, then the first fruits go through to Pentecost, to Shavuot. So you've got this idea of a unit here. You think of, we call them the spring feasts, and I guess that's a good idea because it's like it's a whole story. It's a whole great story from beginning to the end of this thing. Now, as we look at this and we look at where all these things interact, one of the questions that when we're looking on ideas of timing and this and that, was a question of the first fruits of the harvest. Now we get that idea that the first fruits of the harvest being connected with Yeshua, it's very clear. I mean, Paul brings it up again and again and again that Yeshua is the first fruits of the dead, and that kind of thing. The idea, this connection that Paul makes with that is quite clear. And the timing of first fruits being somewhere around the time period of where Yeshua was risen is also quite significant. Because as we've been seeing, things were happening. Yeshua came in on Lamb Selection Day. He was on the cross at the right specific moment of the Passover sacrifice. He went into the grave there, just as the Sabbath of the first day of unleavened bread was starting. And then the question then comes up on first fruits. Now, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, historically, at this particular time period when Yeshua was there, there were two main groups of thought. And actually it broke down even further than that. You've got on one side the Pharisees who had the idea that, and this is all based primarily on the Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23, that is where we get all of the list of the festivals and this and that, that of this particular time period. So the question then comes down is the Pharisees on one hand had the idea that when it says in Leviticus 23:11 that, on the morrow of the Shabbat, that is when you raise this thing and you present this, the wave offering. Okay. That is when that's presented. So then you had the two schools of thought. The Pharisees said, Well, the morrow after the Shabbat, that means the morrow after the first festival, and as we talked about it, 14th day Passover, 15th day is the first day of unleavened bread, and then that would mean the 16th day would be the time of first fruits. That was the Pharisaical opinion. Now, the Sadduceical opinion was the idea that when it said that the morrow of the Shabbat, that meant the weekly Sabbath, because that was the idea that Shabbat was Shabbat, and that was Shabbat, so that was the weekly Sabbath, so the morrow of the Shabbat would be, as you would say, the first day of the week. So, yes.
There's a third position.
Yes.
That the morrow is not translated correctly and should be translated next.
We'll get to that in just a moment. Now, the question of this comes down, there was also the Sadducees and the folks at Qumran were kind of in the Sadduceical position, except that the folks that were at Qumran that are associated with the Dead Sea Scrolls, they had this idea that it was actually the week after the unleavened bread. So they were always like 1 week later than even the Sadducees were. But they also had this idea of the first day of the week and that sort of thing. Now the Pharisees, as we were mentioning before, their position. If we were to just kind of look at this from the idea of the Pharisaical position, you know, the Pharisees. Pharisees, man, my poor bad handwriting there. One of their idea is, of course, they, I guess, held to the 16th, and Sadducees. They held to, I guess it would be the morrow. We'll just call it morrow of Shabbat for right now. Meaning the seventh day of Shabbat. That's what their thought. And when it says 16th, this is the 16th day of the first month. Okay. So that's one thing that they have in there. The interesting thing, though, is that the Septuagint, which predates the Masoretic text by at least 1,000 to 1,300 years, and that's, you know, pretty much the whole Old Testament here is based upon the Masoretic text. All the Hebrew that you have in there is based on the Masoretic text. The earliest manuscripts that we have of it are 1,000. There's also the Aleppo one that comes from 925 is the earliest one for that. So those Masoretic that we have is from that time period. Now, when you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, the fragments that we do have and the areas that we do have it, when you compare the Masoretic, it is, you know, spot on, like 99% of the time. However, when you look at the Septuagint in Leviticus 23, it says something that's a bit different than the Masoretic text. What the Septuagint has is that if you were to just start there at verse 5 of Leviticus 23. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, between the evening times of the Lord's Passover, and on the 15th day of this month, is the feast of unleavened bread to the Lord. 7 days you will eat leavened bread, and on the first day shall be a holy convocation to you. You shall do no servile work. And you will offer whole burnt offerings to the Lord for 7 days. And the seventh day will be a holy convocation to you. You will do no servile work. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, and you will say to them, 'When you enter the land which I give you, and reap the harvest of it, then you will bring a sheaf, the first fruits of your harvest, to the priest. And he shall lift a sheaf up before the Lord to be accepted for you. On the morrow of the first day, the priest will lift it up. And you will offer on the day which you bring the sheaf a lamb without blemish, a year old, for a burnt offering to the Lord. It is a meat offering. 2/10 portions of fine flour mingled with oil is a sacrifice to the Lord, a sweet smell, savor to the Lord, and a drink offering and such." And if you move down to verse 14, "And you will not eat bread for the new or the new parched corn until the same day, until you offer the sacrifices to your God. It is a perpetual statute through your generations in all your dwellings. And you shall remember to your number to yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day on which you offer the sheaf of the heave offering, 7 full weeks, until the morrow after the last week, you shall number 50 days, and you shall bring a new meat offering to the Lord." So that's what the Septuagint has in there, which is obviously a bit different from the Masoretic text in that regard, in that, you know, you have to remember that the Septuagint was a Greek translation of the Bible that was done in Alexandria, some between the 3rd century BC and the 1st century BC. Most of it which was done at the earliest point and kind of modified as it went forward. But most of it was done at that time period. So there was also an issue of that it is, in some cases, a dynamic translation, kind of like the New International Version is today. A dynamic translation versus a literal translation means that the interpreter, or I should say in this case, the translator puts it into words that make sense for that given day and time. That's why NIV will read differently in certain places based on what the translator was thinking that the meaning of the phrase meant at that time. So what does that mean for the Septuagint? That means that we are getting a snapshot of what people thought of this particular passage in the 3rd century BC. So that is what we get that idea from. So in that case, what they were thinking in that time period was that, like in verse 11, on the morrow of the first day, and as it mentions earlier, the morrow of the first day of unleavened bread. So first day of unleavened bread, the 15th, that would be the 16th, which is why Philo, when he writes, he was using the Septuagint, as most of the apostles did for most of their stuff. I mean, Paul did use the Hebrew text we can see in some passages, but for a lot of what he quoted was from the Greek translation. So, in this case, you've got the Septuagint, which, if you ever see this when people are writing about the Bible, you'll see LXX. That means Septuagint. Obviously, that's
shorthand.
That's shorthand, because that's 70. So it's 70 in Roman numerals. So that is referring to the Septuagint. So the Septuagint goes along with that particular side there. Now, there's other stuff also regarding this passage of on the morrow. The passage of on the morrow literally means the next day, because morrow is from Middle English, which means morve, and morve comes from morgen from German, and morgen in German means dawn. So that is always referring to the next dawn. So, that is one of the challenges. Yeah, you have a question there, Richard?
No.
Okay.
I know, and I mean, I understand as far as words of how they've been translated and the translations from the Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
But massive numbers of translations does not necessarily make a fit, because when you've got a puzzle piece and all of the puzzle piece has two indentations and two out indentation or external ones, you can put all the pieces around it, but if you, of the other things you know, if those pieces do not fit because each one of them has a hole where it shouldn't be, no matter how much evidence of them, they still don't fit. All the pieces have to fit. Some of this obviously has to be reverse engineered, because there are a lot of it, well, like the morrow, it can mean next. It can mean that very next Sabbath.
We're not talking about, it's the Hebrew word, not the English.
Not the English and not Greek. And so,
but the question though is that the Greek that we have predates the Hebrew that we have. So we have to at least acknowledge that.
I totally acknowledge that.
Yeah.
Problem is, it leaves us with other, deadly.
Well, let's then at least look at some of these implications of one side or the other side. I mean, we have to at least do that if we are going to be honest and look at what the implications are on this. Because, you know, one of the things that the Samaritans actually, they obviously are over on this camp here on the morrow of the Shabbat like that. They actually had names for the 7 weeks of the Feast of Weeks. And they, like, the first week was crossing the Red Sea. You know, the second week was the water at Marah. And, you know, then you've got the 12 springs and the 70 palms. The fourth week being, you know, which this man comes down we had the manna. Then we've got the fifth week, the water coming out of the rock, the battles with Amalek on the sixth, and of course, seventh is there you are at Sinai. So on that sort of a sense, we do have that connection there of where they saw regarding the Shabbat and the time factors there of these weeks leading up to Sinai. So that being there, that is a thing to look at as well. So now just suppose for a moment, you know, that as we were looking, suppose that the Sadducees are absolutely correct on what they're saying, that this position is absolutely correct. Now, obviously, that view is warranted by the passage here that comes from Hebrew and such regarding the morrow of the Shabbat. That would be obviously onto the first day and such like that. Now, that is the valid reading of that. Now, another implication would be that it would be warranted because first fruits and the Feast of Weeks are the only days of the appointed times that have no set date. They have no set date. I mean, all the other ones, like you think of the Lamb Selection Day, 10th day of the first month. You've got Passover, 14th day of the first month. You've got unleavened bread, the 15th day and the 21st day, and on and on and on. However, and of course, obviously, the seventh day of the week. So what then are the implications of having no set day? Now, one view is that because there is no set day of the month, there is no set day of the month, and it will move within the month. So if this indeed is the morrow of Shabbat, that could be whatever day of the month that particular thing would be in. So that would be whatever day. It could be, you know, anywhere up to within a few days of after Passover. It could be 3 days and three nights after Passover. That's a possibility. It is an indeed possibility that, you know, you have to consider in that regard. Now, you also have to consider that both the early writings of the believers in Messiah, both of those who are advocates, both of those who are advocates for Sunday as being the day, you know, following the day of the sun and such, and kind of coalescing the resurrection around Sunday, and both those that held to the idea that, no, God said Shabbat, that is his day about creation, and that continues onward. Both of those and all of their writings all say that Messiah rose on the first day of the week. Now, that is what they mention there. So, the implication of that is, that would be also another thing to say that, yeah, the Sadducees are absolutely correct in this regard. That that would be the morrow after the Shabbat. Now, another thing to think about is that Sadducees themselves also rejected a lot of, as Messiah would say it, the traditions of the fathers. They rejected all that. They held to the pretty much the Tanakh and the Tanakh only, mostly the Torah, but also they did accept the prophets to a certain degree. However, they did not accept things such as angels and miracles and resurrection. Obviously, is a big one that they didn't go for in that regard.
Jeff, I have a question. I've always
had,
it doesn't actually say that he rose. They found the tomb empty, but it doesn't say, I mean, they would not have gone in the middle of the night and checked the tomb. So they found an empty tomb. It doesn't say that he rose right then.
That's right.
So why is there the big argument? I mean, they don't really know when he left.
The thing, though, is to look at this, is that as we've been looking at through Matthew 27, God does things on time.
Mm-hmm.
He does things on time, even down to excruciating detail. I mean, Susan went into it with the Passover lamb and how all of the things that they did related specifically of the things that Messiah was going through related a lot to what the lamb was going through. So, if there was that much congruence on there, there must be some other congruence. I mean, that would just, being God is logical and God goes to great extent. I mean, you look at, you know, when we've gone through Exodus and such, where it talks about the tabernacle in unbelievably excruciating detail. So these things relate to that. Now, granted, what you said is absolutely correct. And it does not say, you know, Yeshua rose on the third hour, and it does not say that. It does not say that. It does say that, and it says this several times, that he rose on the third day, after 3 days, this and that mm-hmm. and the other. You do also have the possibility that, and early believers did connect with this, that the sign of Jonah, with 3 days and three nights, was also connected to resurrection. So somehow this 3 days had something to do with the resurrection. And if you look at where God is going with this unit, we're talking like the spring feasts, it's a whole story. It's a whole story. And, you know, other people have gotten in, or I mean, Richard and Daniel have gotten into this whole lot more of what this story is. But, you know, as we're going through this and looking in Matthew's account of what's going on, we have to see that there is a story here where Yeshua's life is fitting upon a pattern of what was put before and what persists on, so that nobody else could make that claim to be who he is.
Right.
I mean, not only to the fact of that, I mean, with the temple destroyed, you can't even verify genealogy anymore to any accurate degree. So, yeah.
But you can't have any fatal errors. Okay? It all has to fit. You have to have 3 days and three nights in the count. You have to have resurrected on the third day in the count. You can't have the Sabbath broken on day of Pentecost by chapter 19, Exodus, verse 10. Then the people said to Moses, God said to Moses, go to the people, sanctify them today and tomorrow, let them wash their clothes, and then let them be ready. Right here it says wash their clothes, and I think it does say wash their bodies, but ready on the third day, for on the third day, Yah will come up on the mountain. You've got to, that cannot be breaking the Sabbath. All of these have to fit. You can't have any fatal errors. They have a fatal error. They have two fatal errors.
Well, the question is two questions, actually. And we have to address them honestly.
I agree.
Is that, number one, is that could the dead be taken care of on a Shabbat?
Yes. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay, so there's one thing that we have to consider. Secondly, does Sinai have to be on the first day of the week? Just entertain that for a moment.
Does it have to be? No, I don't think it is on the first day of the week.
Okay. If it were on the sixth day of the week, what were the 3 days leading up to that? Would there be a Shabbat in there anyway?
That could work.
We just have to at least entertain the possibilities.
See, all of them have to fit. That's why I'm saying a puzzle piece.
Right.
All of them have to fit with no fatal errors.
Because we're looking at a picture of a story here. So let's just keep looking at this some more and see if something will come out of it. So, you know, if this passage here, you know, if the Sadducees are right in their position, so what are the implications of that? The implications are is that the first fruit offerings is always waived on first day of the week, or if we're just going to use a general term, morrow of the Shabbat. Always. That is always it, because it's always pegged to that particular time period. Okay, so that's one implication of it. The next implication is that the count of the 7 weeks, or if you want to use the term Shabbaton or Shavuot, if you want to use that term, starts from the first day of the week, or if we just want to use the general term, morrow of the Shabbat, it always starts on that particular time. So, yeah. Daniel.
Quick question. You explained earlier morrow referring to the following day.
Yeah.
Morrow actually means morning, which you morning. Your definition you pointed out. It is equally valid to state that statement's morrow of the Shabbat means the daytime of the Shabbat, because the Shabbat has a nighttime and it has a daytime, and they're distinct and separate. And it could mean that morrow of the Shabbat is referring to not Sunday, it means the day portion of a Shabbat versus the night portion of a Shabbat.
Well, I mean, that's a good question. The challenge, though, is that on the morrow, there's also something that Shakespeare was fond of. In the morrow always refers to next day, always next morning.
Well, we're not talking Shakespeare here.
No, but what I'm talking about, though,
the slight error in that, you know that Shakespeare, but he's English.
Right.
All right. So the English don't count their days such that the sun goes down, thus the next day is begun. They don't count it that way. They have
exactly.
That concept is a Middle Eastern idea.
Exactly.
So in using the term morrow, we're in the morrow for the next day, well, that would be logical. Because if it's today, like for today's Saturday, well, tomorrow, Saturday, being English, would obviously refer to Sunday, because I'm English, or American, or European. In a Jewish concept, or Middle Eastern concept, if I'm speaking in the middle of the night, let's say it's last night, Friday night, or Sliya, well, we call it Friday night, but it would be Shabbat night. I say, well, in the morrow of Shabbat. Well, being Jewish, you think of, oh, tomorrow of Shabbat. That would be daytime. I mean, the next event of Shabbat is day portion versus night portion.
So it's
difficult using a Greek or European mindset when thinking of days.
But the challenge, though, is that
the Middle Eastern mindset of the day.
In Alexandria, they were Jews, though.
Right.
I mean, granted, they were Hellenized Jews, but they still were Jews who were looking at that.
That didn't change their words, though.
Right, that's what I'm saying. When they moved it over in the Septuagint translated, on the morrow of the Shabbat is the same as it would mean in English.
What would you use, or give correction, what would they have used if they were referring to daytime of the Shabbat? What is the statement they should have put in there?
What is the
proper word that they chose? If that's what they were after, like say, for example, I can say, well, tomorrow, or I can say, well, morning.
Yeah.
Those two different things. Tomorrow can be any point in time. Morning can be obviously a set point in time. I choose a particular word to refer to a time slot by my choice of words. It dictates whatever. So if I was Jewish, living in Alexandria, and I need to use Greek words referring to morning portion of the day, what word do I use if I'm using morrow? That is the word available to me. What's the other alternative referring to the day portion of a day versus the night portion of the day?
Well, what they're referring to is morning.
Which could be Shabbat morning.
No, but we're talking on the morrow.
Right.
That meaning in Greek. Next morning. That is what the Greek is. It's not that morning, it's next morning.
Okay, so what is that morning then?
Hmm?
What is the word for that morning?
That morning?
Yes, rather than next morning. If you're saying morrow means next morning, what is the word for that morning? Do you know what it is?
Well, it's a different one that was used in that particular space.
What I'm arguing is there actually isn't one.
Susan, do you have a thought?
Well, I just, because earlier on in this discussion, the word Shabbat was understood, the Shabbaton could also refer to a week.
Yes.
Right?
That's correct.
And Baruch Levine and Jacob Milgram, both very good scholars, have variously understood Shabbat to mean week in the present context of Leviticus 23:11.
Yes.
So that would then bring you kind of more on the side of the Sadducees, wouldn't it? In verse 16, the phrase, in other words, that in that, it's the week on the, so it would be the beginning of the week, right? The next day, which would make it the first day of the week.
I don't get to where you're going with that.
Well, because what is the context of the argument? What's the crux of the argument here? That you're saying, what I understand you to be saying is that Yeshua was raised actually on the Sabbath of the Passover week, on the Saturday Sabbath, during the day of the Sabbath, right?
That's my personal belief, yes.
Okay, but what these two argue, the Pharisees and the Sadducees are arguing, the Pharisees are saying the 16th of Nisan, whatever day of the week that fell on. But coincidentally, that would mean it would never, ever fall on what we call a Sunday, the first day of the week.
Correct.
And this argument stems from the first century.
Yes.
Right?
Correct.
That's correct.
Right, probably, it seems, right around the time of the resurrection.
Yes.
And so that there was an agenda for the Pharisees to make sure that going on in time into Judaism, that it would never, ever, ever be connected with the resurrection of a man who claimed to be the Messiah.
But actually, though, this argument does predate the first century.
It does predate the first century.
It certainly does.
Okay, because some scholars...
Almost 200.
I don't...
Some scholars state it to them.
Yeah. So, it's time for us to wrap up here.
Hillel the first discussed this argument 200 years before the Messiah.
He did?
Yeah. So, let's leave it at this, and we'll pick it up the next week, or the next time we take a look at this. And what we'll take a look at in the next phase is a little bit more on this idea of this contention here between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, because there are some other pieces to the puzzle of where these things fit in. And I'll give you a hint. It's got everything to do with Lamb Selection Day and the number 7. Okay? Everything to do it. Now, if you want to look into it further, just think about this. Lamb Selection Day and number 7. And when we talk about pieces fitting, it's a possibility that that could help things fit. And it will also explain a lot more of what the story is that's going on here. So let's just leave it at that and close with prayer. Father God, we thank you and praise you for giving us minds that can comprehend you. And Father, we just thank you for giving us wisdom and helping us to sort through these things, because we know that there's an important story here. We thank you for giving us the story and for helping us to understand it more. Father, we thank you for all these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.